Welcome back to the program. We all view the world from our own personal experience. For most of us, that means that we understand September 11th to mean one particular thing. For our guest today, Ariel Dorfman, September 11th was in 1973 and represents a day that his dream was also deferred. But it was a different dream, that of a free and democratic Chile, a dream that would begin to end on that day and begin events that would ultimately lead him into exile and into a 17-year search to define himself and to define what it means to be human. In the process, he learned about compassion, courage, and what reconciliation was really all about. He takes us all with him on this journey in his new book, Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile. Ariel Dorfman is an internationally acclaimed author of works of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, including the best-selling memoir, Heading South, Looking North. His play, Death and the Maiden, has been staged in over 100 countries, and his books published in more than 40. It is my pleasure to welcome Ariel Dorfman back to this program to talk about his newest memoir, Feeding on Dreams. Ariel Dorfman, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here in San Francisco, which, after all, is my old hunting grounds, because I was here in 68, 69, and I've come back very frequently. I love this Bay Area.
It's interesting. It's a good place to start. You have this connection to the Bay Area, and, of course, you grew up on the streets of New York and spent so many years in South America, in Latin America. Talk a little bit about this bifurcation of your own view of North and South.
Well, you know, first of all, this was not something I sought. It's something, in fact, I fought against very, very drastically, I could say, radically. Meaning that when I was a child, I was born in Argentina. I got to the States when I was 2.5. I became an American kid, didn't want to speak any Spanish for reasons that I won't even go into at this point. And then because of McCarthy, I was forced to follow my parents to Chile, where I fell in love with the country. So I was resolutely monolingual in English only, and then resolutely monolingual in Spanish only. And then when the coup came against Allende in 1973 on September 11th, as you say, I found myself in a strange position, which was that I was bilingual. I had Spanish and English. I was part of Latin America. I'd been brought up as a kid in New York, and I had been in San Francisco and Berkeley for several years. But I wanted to say the only way of going back home is to keep my Spanish alive and not use my English. And, of course, English is an extraordinary, not only a beautiful, wonderful, you know, eloquent language, but it's also a language which is an instrument that I could use. For instance, I'm able to speak to you on this program as if I were a Native American, let's say an American who's native to this country. And so I found that history was saying that this bifurcation, this idea that I belong to only one place, was wrong. I belong to at least two places and several places, and I belong to many communities. So what I've done is I've turned the fact that history has constantly been pushing me from one country to the other, from one language to the other, from different cultures, into something that, rather than something that I reject, it's something which I embrace, which I accept, and I see as a form of richness. There's a great loss, of course, in the fact, you know, that I'm really not only one thing. Because when you're only one thing, life is very simple for you and not painful. But the richness of the experience of being both American and Latin America, being an Americano, being from the Americas, means that I fulfill a destiny which I see as the destiny of being a bridge, which is what I'm doing right now.
And yet that is one of the tensions in the world today as we all become more global citizens as a result of globalization and communication and travel and all the other things. It takes away exactly what you're talking about. It takes away that simplicity of being anchored in one place, and the loss of that simplicity is what creates some of the tension that we see today.
I think you're absolutely right about that. But the solution to that is, first of all, I would suggest that the solution is that we are all in some community, and we owe ourselves to those communities that we live in. And if we keep certain ethical principles, and if we are loyal to those in our community, in other words, we're loyal to them and we're, we have solidarity with them, then though life doesn't become simple again, it does become morally simple in the sense of morally clear about who we owe ourselves to. So I think the real problem is that if you become rootless, but I speak about a rooted cosmopolitanism, in other words, being rooted in humanity and then in certain places, in certain very, very specific places. But, you know, if you think about the last centuries, there have been so many wars because of nationality and locality. And I think we should try to get rid of that sense of, I only belong here. Well, it turns out I belong in many places. And that's why I'm so much against war, besides all the horror that it creates. This sense of not being in conflict with one another because of the difference of who we are. And we have many different identities. So if we could just, as I tried to look, this, by the way, is not something that I sort of fell into. It's something that I struggled for, this that I hope is wisdom in relation to identity. It's in the book. I mean, in Feeding on Dreams, I speak about how I go from country to country trying to figure out who I am. And I think I have now settled into a feeling that just because I speak English and Spanish, or because I was born in Argentina and I lived in Chile and I'm loyal to the Chileans and that cause, and I'm loyal also to the other America, you know, the America of Whitman, you know, just to give an example. I mean, I can belong to all these places.
How did you deal with that, or how did you come to that during the 16 and a half years of your exile experience?
I think I'd have to make a great summary of the book, and the book is very detailed about the experiences that I have. But I think that as I begin to realize that exile is not only the pain of being homeless, of not having, you know, not recognizing the milk on your doorstep, not having your, not watching your nieces or your nephews born, not being there for the funeral of your friends, not having your family, your community around you all the time, and living in foreign lands and being treated terribly and being, you know, worrying about the police picking you up or deporting you, all these things that are really great pain. There are also certain things that exile gives you, that expatriation gives you, which is that distance, that learning of other cultures, that learning of other experiences, I think is something that deepens your humanity. But it took me a long time before I decided that was what was my fate. This is what I had to learn. Because, of course, before that, you're struggling always to go back. Now, what really happened to me is that I struggled for 16 and a half years, really, and 17 years, to go back to Chile. I did go back to Chile in 1990 when democracy returned. I also returned. We were able to go back. And we discovered that the country itself had changed so much, and that I had changed so much. I had learned so much abroad. I had expanded so much abroad that in some sense the country no longer fit, or I no longer fit into the country. And that was a very, the book speaks about that experience of what it is to come back to a land that you no longer entirely recognize, that has ceased to be your own because your dream for it is no longer the dream of the majority of the people in it. So, I mean, I think many, many Americans feel the same thing about their own land. They don't recognize it. You know, this whole Occupy Wall Street movement is about the fact that many of these young people don't feel that this is their land. This is not the land that you know, this is your land, this is my land, this is the land for you and me. They feel that's no longer so. That they don't recognize America. Well, the same thing that happens to them in relation to America happens to me in relation to Chile very often. That was not the country that I recognized. So having to discover that with all the pain that means was also a way of saying, you know what, however, I belong in many different places. So I leave Chile, and I leave Chile with the voices of Chile inside me. And when I went to the United States, when I went to Chile itself, I go with the voice of the United States inside me. So those voices can travel.
And for you, the experience is even more complex and deeper because you were not the first exile in your family, that this was a generational issue for you and your family.
Indeed, it goes way, way back to, you know, to my grandparents who had left. You know, they were Jews from the diaspora of Odessa and Kishinev, and they went to Argentina. And then my parents, who twice were uprooted, or three times were uprooted, and I had been uprooted myself. So it comes from a long history of wandering. And of course, the more you wander, the more you want to settle. You don't want to wander all your life. And I think I certainly have stopped. I haven't stopped traveling because I'm here. You know, I live in Durham, North Carolina, But I've stopped wandering in that sense. I'm no longer somebody who doesn't have. I know where I'm going to die. At least I think I know where I'm going to die. And I have my grandchildren here in this country because I feel that this is the story of America in a great measure. It's my story. I belong here in that sense, but I also belong in Chile. And I don't, you know, there's not a need to see it as either or. Identity is not either or. It's emerging. It's always, you know, the identity of the United States itself is emerging of many, many different cultures and ethnicities and languages of different sorts. The problem is when you sort of engage in fundamentalism about your identity and say it can only be this one thing. And that leads to simplification, not to simplicity. And that, I think, is a real enemy of progress.
Talk about the 3 years of the Allende government that you spent in Chile as part of that government, really with a deep sense of belonging and a sense that you were changing the world.
Well, I mean, you know, this was a government that tried to create socialism, social justice, through the ballot box and not the bullet. It was the first experiment in history, which I think is very important, nonviolent, a peaceful transition towards a more just society. Which was different from all the other revolutions before, which were armed struggles, and therefore have all the problems of armed struggle and all the problems of militarism that comes from armed struggle and from one party being in control. So there's a pluralistic solution to that, and he was overthrown. And that was a very fundamental experience for me because, in a sense, when I saw the people of Chile coming out of exile, out of this internal exile, people who had built the streets but didn't have their name on the street, the streets, there wasn't their names there, it was the name of other people, you know, who had built the banks but had no loans for the banks, who had tilled the earth but had no food from the earth. When all those people came out of this anonymity and began to be the center and protagonist of their own history, they were at the same time taking this exile who was me, who had already, you know, had three uprootings of my life. They were taking me along with them because nobody was asking where you're from at that point, as they always asked me, but where are we going? So we're going together to some better place. And when you're doing that, hallelujah, you know, it's almost a mystical experience. The loss of that, the defeat, because it wasn't only the loss of the country, it was the defeat of that project, was perhaps the most depressing thing that happened to me. And I lapsed into a very, very serious crisis after the coup. I speak about, you know, the book is full of little anecdotes. I speak about how I was sitting on a toilet seat in a miserable Paris hotel, clacking at a typewriter, saying, how could we have been so mistaken? In other words, how could we have made the mistake that we promised paradise and we ended up with hell? That we ended up with this terrible dictator instead of having, you know, all the children not hungry. How did that happen? And so I entered into a really, really very, very deep crisis out of which I came through my writing. It's my writing and the finding of this voice, the very voice with which I'm speaking to you now, which is the voice that saved me in exile in some sense.
And
it gave me a grounding somewhere.
You were able to channel or to work with the rage that you had after that dream died.
Yes, yes. That's another thing. You know, I left Chile, and one of the wonderful things about exile, the good things about exile, is you don't have to meet the people you don't like, the people, you know, the people who are torturing your friends, the people who are executing your friends, the people who keep you out of the country, the people who are making money off the suffering of others. You don't have to meet them. You just go to a place where in Paris or in Amsterdam or in Washington D.C. and you don't have to meet these people. So I found that I thought, oh, I'm very peaceful with all this. And then one day I did meet one of them. We were trying to expel Chile from the Pen Club in The Hague in Holland. And he came up to me, and this man had been the man who had personally persecuted. He had taken over he was the librarian of Congress, let's say, for the military dictatorship. And he had personally, you know, censored books, kicked out friends of mine from that library, and now come to Europe to defend Pinochet, saying that there were no political prisoners, that this was the freest country in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And then, so I met him on the steps. I tell this in the book. I meet on the steps of the Hotel des Indes in The Hague, And he comes up, and he without my realizing what was happening, I had never met him, he put this clammy, sweaty, horrible, bland, I can't say it, this, I still feel it in my hand. He sort of thrust his hand into my hand and said, "Oh, colega," you know, my colleague. He says, "I hope that in spite of our political differences, we can be friends," you know, something like that, where we're all Chileans after all. And I reacted with such rage, such horror. I jumped back from him and I said, "Don't touch me! How dare you touch me?" And you know, murderer of these people, and all, you know, and it all spewed out. And the Dutch who were there ended up doing something which was very embarrassing for everybody. They applauded me, and of course there was indignation there, which was justified. But I didn't like what it did to me. I didn't like the pleasure that I felt with the rage inside me coming out like that. I didn't like the person that I was. I didn't like being so angry at him. I didn't like the fact that if I had had a gun, I could have shot him, you know, and instead of my finger pointed at him. I didn't like that in me. And when I did go back to Chile, I found that, and I still have this anger in me. You know, I'm not a saint. I am not perfect. But what I've tried to do is find some way in which I can understand that my enemies are also human, and that I should not engage in this rage. I say in this book that anger is very good for surviving. It's very good. It gives you courage to survive. It is not very good for organizing your life around it. And this is something that I discovered. Again, it's discovered all through the book. It's very slow, the process. I think the reader will hardly realize how it is I come to this conclusion, because I also do it through what I'm writing. I'm hoping, you know, that people will come along from this book and will sort of accompany me on this journey, on this story, and that they will see that every one of the decisions that I made were in some sense inevitable, given my thirst for justice, given my guilt at having survived, and given the horrors that I was confronting in relation to torture and repression.
And part of that, though, is that when you finally made your way to the U.S., that there was the knowledge that the U.S. had been complicit in the overthrow of the Allende government.
Well, this was a thing that made me feel very ambiguous. I came to the United States several times before I finally settled in here, you know, which was a long, long, long time after the coup. And, of course, you know, I say in this book that I would walk along in Washington, D.C., I would walk along the big facades next to the facades of the buildings, and I knew that behind those buildings there had been conspiracies to destroy the dream that I still held, you know, and destroy my country, and that there were people who were complicit there. But I say also that at the same time, when I was in the middle of all of that, I would hear from a street vendor, he had his radio on, and I would hear Ella Fitzgerald crooning some Gershwin tune, I think, or some Cole Porter tune. And, you know, Cole Porter, Gershwin, Ella Fitzgerald, jazz, that's also America. You know, America is, as I say in the book, you know, it's when Emerson goes to see Thoreau when he's jailed for civil disobedience, he said, "What are you doing in there?" And Thoreau says, "No, the question is, what are you doing out there? Why aren't you in here with me?" Now, that's America. So I feel as if the America of Nixon and Kissinger that overthrew Allende is one America. And the other America is the America of Pete Seeger, let's say, right? Or it's the America of some most wonderful, you know, I mean, this is an extraordinary country. And I very proudly say I am American in that sense. But when I say I'm American, I don't mean I am American, I'm gringo. No, I mean I'm American in the best ways that this country allows people to be many, many things. And I think that's one of the things we need to do in this country. We need to look at that richness and say, we are not going to allow this fundamentalism to destroy the wonderful tapestry of difference that there is in different people. And that's why America does have something to teach the world, if it could only decide that that's what it wants to export rather than exporting war.
And part of the way you came to this understanding of reconciliation was trying to find a more humanistic voice.
Yes, it was humanistic in the sense that I do speak constantly about, I mean, what does it mean to belong to humanity? Now, this can be just a phrase, or it can be understood as, well, you know, for instance, my library. I am every book I've ever read. we all are the books we've read. So when you think about belonging to humanity, well, you can read Dostoevsky. You can read an Albanian poet. You can read an Urdu storyteller. And you become them in some sense when you're reading all this. So the writing and the reading and the solidarity with others, the understanding of the difference of others, and not, you know, not necessarily saying, I am this person, I am like that person, but you belong in many, many different ways. So I think that there's a sort of humanity, humanism, which I've embraced, and which has to do also with that sense of courage, the courage to be, I think, to reconcile with the complexity of human existence.
And that is not an easy process to do.
It's not easy. It's not easy. I mean, I don't want, you know, one of the things that the book is about is not to lie about myself, not to lie about what I've done and the mistakes I may have made. Because the book is called Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile, and I am unrepentant about the process, but I have regrets about how I got there. It's not easy always when you're confused, when you're young, when you have, when you've lost everything. Just to give you an example, you know, in this process of becoming part of a reconciliation with the world, this process is one where you end up being at times using people. You know, for instance, you use people, you say, you know, I'm against Pinochet, I'm against this general, I'm against the dictatorship, and therefore anything I do is justified. Or you embrace being a victim, you feel very good about being a victim. So you say, oh, I'm a victim, I can do anything, because after all, look at what bad shape I am. So you end up using people. There are things that, in other words, things that don't necessarily fill me with pleasure for having done.
And that's where the parallels are so interesting to the 9/11 that happened in 2001 versus 1973.
Well, yes. I mean, I wrote a piece recently about how the United States had reacted in a very different way from Chile to the 9/11, you know, their 9/11, our 9/11, let's say, right? There are two 9/11s. In fact, there are more, as I'll explain very soon. So it turns out you know, the United States, when it had this moment of terror that came to it, it was a test. The test is, if the terror comes to you, as it inevitably must in life, at some point you will be the victim of some terrible aggression. If this is what your story is, if this is what's going to happen to you, then perhaps what you need to do is figure out how you're going to, are you going to flunk the test? In other words, are you going to, the real question that comes from any act of terror is, are you going to become like the terrorist? In order to fight the terrorist, are you going to become like him or like her? Generally him, you know, generally they're men. And in the case of the United States, I think really that unfortunately, the reaction, it was a terrible crime, you know, 3,000 people dying. It was a tremendous, horrible crime that was done there. But if you look at what the result of the reaction to that crime was, the hundreds of thousands who died because of that, the countries that have been invaded because of that, the erosion of civil liberties back home, the waste of billions and billions and billions of dollars that could have been used for education, for health, and for the young, and for, I mean, so many different ways of using that money. If you think about what 9/11 wrought, I think the United States failed that test, failed it very drastically. It's very sad. The people who didn't fail it were the first responders and the people who went in solidarity and the people who rescued others and those who feel that this is their country and they don't want it turned into a police state. They don't want it turned into an imperial overreacher. But if you look at the case of Chile, we had all the reasons for engaging in an armed struggle against the dictatorship. You know, this was a legitimate government, elected by the people, democratically elected, and yet we decided to use nonviolent resistance, and we got rid of our dictator that way. And we paid a terrible price for this as well, because we had many dead because of this, right? But it turns out that I think that is the beginning of a model of how you do respond to aggression and to pain and to being a victim. And I say the chili, strangely enough, was echoing without knowing it, because I don't think people were aware of that. I certainly wasn't aware of it at the time. We were echoing another September 11th in the year 1906, when Gandhi organized his compatriots in South Africa to go against a law which in fact preceded apartheid but was preparing for it. And this use of nonviolent resistance that Gandhi used from this other September 11th, I think, is a way out of the quandary of not having any more September 11th of any sort whatsoever, not having people terrorize one another, or then terrorizing other people because we've been terrorized ourselves.
As you say, all of these events are a kind of test, both for countries and for individuals.
This is absolutely true. This is a test. And I speak about the test for the country, but what I'm interested in this book is to speak about the test for the individual that I am. Meaning, I can be responsible for what I did and for what I went through. And, you know, I just don't think there are that many books out there that tell the story day by day of how you become somebody else, how you become transformed into somebody else, how history transforms you and how you transform history. In some sense, the voice with which I'm speaking, that's what I'm interested in people gaining access to, saying, oh, look how my voice was formed. Look how the vision I've got. Look at how this gentleness I have. Look at what I went through in order to get to this place. So especially for the young today, I think there's a particular message in this book, which is come with me on this trip. Maybe you will learn. Maybe we'll have a dialogue. Because I love the dialogue and the idea that we're in touch with one another in these ways.
It's trite in some ways, perhaps because it's overused, but at the core of all of this is not losing a sense of hope, even in the face of situations like the one you faced in 1973.
Well, it may sound trite, but if you fill it with meaning, then it does make sense. Here's what happens. If you lose that hope, then you're really, really lost. You know, you can lose your country, you can lose your family. In fact, fortunately for me, I didn't lose my family. They came with me on this journey with great sacrifice on their part, both my sons and my wife. You can lose your language. You can lose many things, but you must never, never lose hope. Because hope, it's strange, Jeff, because people often come up to me and say, how can you be so optimistic given what you've lived through? And I answer, given what I've lived through, how can I not be optimistic? How can I afford to be anything other than full of hope? And it may be delusional. I don't think so, though. You know, every time I look at people, I'm always finding examples of people who, in the worst of circumstances, find the best of themselves. You know, these better angels that we constantly are speaking about. Well, they're there always inside every one of the human beings that I've discovered on this journey and that are in this book. They people the book.
Ariel Dorfman, the book is Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile. Ariel Dorfman, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Jeff.